Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. We're here to give you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time, streaming live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We're rebroadcast on Sundays at 3 p.m. Pacific Time on a2zen.fm, and we archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. So lots of opportunity there. If you'd like to help and support what we're doing, I have lots of different ways for you to do it. One, I'll take any energetic support and encouragement that you want to send our way. We can use all of the help that we can get. If you'd like to support us in a more tangible way, then go to the missions page at richarddugan.com. And there are two links at the bottom of that page. One is to PayPal and the other one is GoFundMe.com. So whatever you can do, we're grateful for that support. That said, we also would like to hear from you. Our email address is richard@richarddugan.com. That's richard@richarddugan.com. And easy enough for you to find that. And if you're wanting to find out more about our guests, well, you go to the same website and you either go to the schedules page of upcoming guests or you go to the radio show page where guests have already appeared on the station on the program and click on their link. And it'll take you on their name, and it'll take you to their website. We don't reinvent the wheel here at Tell Me Your Story. That was done. It was done very well. And besides, I wouldn't get any credit for reinventing it anyway, because it's already been invented. Today's program is going to be, from my perspective, extraordinary. It is going to be dealing with a multitude of subjects from one guest. He's a writer, he's a producer, he's a director. He has several films, documentaries that are out. I've seen one of them, both of the DVDs, on Life After Death. Extraordinary, and I'm impressed by the way that it was put together. There is another one that we're going to talk about as well called Before We Say Goodbye, going back to 2010. And he's also produced the documentary Jesus in India. His name is Paul Davids, and I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program. This is going to be one fast hour because it always goes by fast when these kinds of things are talked about. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Richard.
This is a first of all, I'm going to start with Life After Death. And Ackerman is the gentleman's name who passed on, and the documentary is about him. And I have to say that is the one thing, the one element that for me makes the information, I'll call it evidence, so compelling. You weren't jumping around from one dead person to the next and going to their relatives and trying to support this. You focused on one individual. And one individual only. And the experiences that those who were left behind, namely you and your friends and family, and your experiences since his passing. And that to me is what's missing from a lot of these films that talk about life after death.
Well, you know, you see on television a lot of films where they're people who are ghost hunting in old houses and graveyards,
yeah,
and trying to make contact with spirits, and they don't know who it is that they're reaching out to, and they don't know who it is who may end up being in contact with them. I didn't set out to do that. As a matter of fact, I didn't even set out to make this film. I didn't choose the topic. I tell people, it chose me. And the reason I say that is that when Forrest J. Ackerman died at age 92. Here's someone who had an enormous influence in the field of science fiction and was my mentor for over 40 years. So I knew every facet of his life and had been a part of the many parts of his life. And this is about the continuation of a relationship beyond death that I didn't initiate. Things started to happen after he passed away. He was a skeptic. He was even an atheist. He didn't subscribe to life after death. But I and a couple other of his friends sort of pinned him down as he got into his 90s, and we said, Fari, you know, what if you're wrong? And he said, I'll tell you what, if I'm wrong, if it's possible to do it, I'll drop you a line. But he didn't think he was going to be wrong, not while he was living. He did drop me a line. I feel that the incidents that relate to his continuing presence number now more than 30. And in the Life After Death Project, we go into all of these, the ones that have the most physical evidence connected with them that science has looked at in several universities, and those that would be more at the fringes of the subject matter that we would call synchronicity, where you have a series of the most extraordinary and seemingly impossible coincidences, the convergence of events that relate to him that seem very, very improbable to have happened by chance. Maybe not impossible, but when you put that together with the evidence that is actually physical evidence and the university attempt by Dr. Gary Schwartz at the University of Arizona, Tucson, to actually contact him using software and sensors in the instrumental transcommunication research he's developed. And you put that also together with some of the mediumship research. And we come at this from four angles. And the presence of Fari Ackerman is so tangible that this is a real challenge to the debunkers and the skeptics. Mm-hmm. I sort of throw down the gauntlet here because after all that's happened, I believe it, and I know what is shown in the Life After Death Project is true.
Well, first of all, this also it touches on the other end of the spectrum. When you start talking about reincarnation, people coming back into this life after having passed from it and sort of starting over or starting from where they left off, that kind of thing. And who knows? He may make his appearance again in another life in 5 years. Maybe it could be 1,000 years. You just never know. But I just find it extraordinary. I have, as a matter of fact, I've talked with so many people about this in regards to life after death and communication from the other side, from the spirit world, if you will. And I, first of all, it's not a subject that you can argue about. It's not like I can sit here and say, no, Paul, I think you're wrong. I think you're absolutely out of your mind, et cetera, et cetera. No. I can't take away your experience. Your experience is just that. And that's where, from my perspective, that's where a lot of people have to start,
well,
to be
Richard,
honest with you.
What I have here is more than my own experience.
Well, true.
First of all, there's been the experience of a number of people that were mm-hmm. close to him who have had things just as unusual and extraordinary happen as what has happened to me. And in very unusual sequences of timing, so that things became clustered around the time of a large tribute for him that was held at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood. Regarding what you were speculating about reincarnation, it's another of those aspects of how to study the whole topic of life after death. Mm-hmm. And I've actually, as you know, produced two feature documentaries here that come in one package,
right,
as the Life After Death Project. The first one was on the Sci-Fi Channel in May. The second one has not been broadcast. In the second one, we get into reincarnation somewhat, but that is something that really requires its own program. And there have been thousands of books written about the topic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I focus here on what is thumbnailed ADC, which is after-death communication. Also a focus on ITC, instrumental transcommunication, which is the concept that if in fact the theory is correct that there are spirits, that there are unseen intelligences that interact with our world, and that it's in essence on a different frequency than the one we operate on all the time, as we know with radio waves and television waves and microwaves, you know, the communication that enables the internet. All of these waves are all around us as intelligent signals all the time. They're passing right through our very own bodies, through the walls of our homes, even if we're inside an elevator, a metal box, you know, these signals can reach us. But if you don't have the way to decode them, if you don't have the right instrument, you'd never even know that it's happening. So how can we know that communication from spirit realm is possible? We have to make a scientific effort to detect it. That's going on right now at the University of Arizona in Tucson. But there does, it seems to me, seem to be an effort by spirit to make itself known to us. And this has been postulated for thousands of years. You know, they referred to miracles, they referred to angels, you know, but who knows how to characterize all that phenomena? And you can look at it and stay away from religion and just say, look, here are some things that are happening that by our physical laws shouldn't be happening.
Yeah.
We don't know how they happen. Sometimes we call it poltergeist activity. And I've seen that, you know, things popping off a wall, things moving around in a house when nobody was there, my own home. The incident that began the Life After Death Project for me was actually the manipulation of words on a document. I was alone in a house. I had a document that had printed out. It's 24 pages, very ordinary. I scanned through it. There was nothing unusual about this when I put it down on the bed. I was out of the room for a few minutes. This was very soon after the tribute for Forrest Ackerman. Very soon after a few other really unusual things that happened to others who were close to him. And when I came back into the room, there was moist ink on the document, very strategically, in a targeted way, blacking out four words, even in two different levels of blackness. You know, the opaqueness or opacity was different. The first two words, you could slightly read, you could slightly see through this moist ink, solvent, whatever it was that had been applied. And in the case of the other two words, completely blacked out. So my point was, and this is what galvanized me into action to begin this whole project. I was alone in the house. That's number one. There was no one else there physically who could have done it. Mm-hmm. That's number two. Number three is it was clearly done deliberately. The words had been selected. It was precise. You know, this is not water dripping from a ceiling or a leaky pen in the bed. No, you can tell those words were selected. So the number three is there was intention behind it, and that means a message. So then number four was the question of, oh, what is the message? Who does it come from? And that analysis led me to dear old Fari Ackerman, who thousands of fans called Uncle Fari, and who I knew and loved for over 40 years. Let me tell you just a few things about him so you'll have your listeners will have a sense of the man we're talking about.
Before you do that, I want to jump in and ask you or have you speculate on this. Ackerman knew you well enough. He knew that if this was going to be the first clue that he was going to drop you a line,
yes,
that was going to be the clue that would kickstart this whole project. Am I correct in that assessment? He knew you well enough that if I do this, man, he's going to jump into action.
The message was sent to the right guy.
Okay. All right. So tell us a little bit about
that. And the proof of that also is the fact that one of my earlier films called The Sci-Fi Boys, that one you can find on Netflix.
Okay.
It's about the development of special effects in movies from the very early silent days up through Peter Jackson's King Kong. And Peter Jackson is a host of it. And I have all the top people in the field from Spielberg and Lucas and Dennis Muren. Guillermo del Toro was a speaker at the tribute for Ackerman. The list goes on and on. The point is, Fari Ackerman influenced all of these people by his magazine. He was the editor, the original editor of what was called Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine. In fact, it's still being published. But Fari was aboard for almost about 200 issues. And it was a unique magazine, began in 1958, and it sort of brought movie monsters and special effects to a young generation for the first time, and with a lot of humor and a lot of insight as to what went on behind the scenes in movie making. So he was Pied Piper to actually two generations of young people who then went into the film business and turned the whole thing around with special effects from being for B-movies, slipshod effects that were originally done in people's garages, mm-hmm. to a multi-billion dollar business that is now one of America's largest exports to the world. Ackerman is in the center of that, the influence that caused that to happen. He was a futurist. And as a futurist, and as someone who looked to science fiction as something that provided clues to our own possible future, it's very logical that he would be the guy who, if he could, if there was physically a way to say, I'm still here. I was wrong. It didn't all end with physical death. There's something else. If there's a way to cross the bridge between the realms, it's logical he'd be the guy to did it, mm-hmm. to do it. And as I'm a filmmaker, this happened to me. It also happened to two other filmmakers who'd made a documentary about him, two guys from Canada. It happened in different ways for them. But what began with a few incidents has continued for about 4 years. And I can say there's more than 30 specific things that have happened that are, they're weird. They're kind of funny. Mm-hmm. Some of them, he had an incredible sense of humor. So there is a prankishness to a lot of this that really makes you want to smile. And for those who really knew him well, these things happen and you can say, well, there's Fari. He's at it again. And he's very welcome to do this. And, you know, I thank him. And I've enjoyed the whole ride. But what I really want to leave with your listeners is this is true. It's accurately reported. It's not exaggeration. It's not exploitation. I didn't choose it. I didn't make any of it up. It started happening to me, and it kept happening. And that's why I put it all together in this documentary.
And the other aspect, as far as accusations of, oh, you're doing this for publicity. Well, Ackerman's not getting any. It's not going to do him any good. He's gone. I mean, in that sense, it's, you know, usually when you do something like this, it's for the benefit of everybody that's involved. Well, he's the centerpiece, but he's not getting any money from it. He's not getting any fame in that respect from where he sits right now. And that's, to me, what's I think that sort of if you haven't accepted any of the other what I like to call coincidences.
Yes.
That's my new pronunciation of that word. I don't believe in mm-hmm. coincidences, but I do mm-hmm. believe in coincidences. Mm-hmm. In the sense that, hey, things happen. They coincide at the same time for a reason. And I think that's one of the reasons why this whole process began, not only for him, but also for you, to help the rest of us. We deal on this program on a regular basis with the subject of, we call it death and dying, but I like to use the word transitioning. Mm-hmm. Trying to not only demystify it, but we're also trying to suck the fear, so to speak, mm-hmm. right out of it, because it is not something to be feared any more than, as far as we know, from our limited knowledge of our pre-existence, we didn't fear our birth, mm-hmm. You know, and that I've heard so many people, I've even heard the description that when you die, it's just like taking off a big old heavy overcoat. That's all it is. It's not a big deal. And
well,
that...
Well, you know, It's one of the biggest mysteries.
Yes.
It faces us all.
Yeah.
And there's so much about it we don't know, but we do know a lot by observing, you know, the dying mm-hmm. and people as they pass away.
Well,
and you know, I mean, sometimes it's a peaceful and easy transition, and
sure.
sometimes it certainly isn't. I mean, some people, you know, die as a result of violence or
sure.
accidents
right.
or you know, a stroke that causes paralysis or comas, or you know, the personality doesn't always maintain its natural integrity all the way up to the end.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be, you know, really troubling, especially if you're losing a loved one, and you
yeah.
ask yourself, well, how is it possible that this person I knew as somebody who was so vital, so full of life and humor and insight that they've now lost the ability to talk because of a stroke, or they're now completely unconscious or wasting away. And then they pass. The body becomes non-biological. You know, it's just inert. It's you have returned to the clay.
Exactly.
So it's hard for us to make a leap in our own mind saying, well, how could personality survive that process? What would be left? What would that consciousness be? How could we exist without a body, let's say? How could we interact with a world that is physical? There's so many questions we don't have the answers to. And of course, the skeptic kind of stops at the door, you know, and says that those
coincidences.
These coincidences. For the skeptic or the debunker, he stops at the door. He doesn't go through that gate. Just says, look, they don't have any meaning. They're accidents. You know, a coincidence is exactly what the word implies, meaning, you know, there's a million things, a trillion things that could happen at any given instant in time, and this just happened to be one of them.
Exactly.
You know, somebody won the lottery. Well, not very likely somebody's going to win the lottery. Similarly, maybe a whole lot of things happen that kind of make you think that Fari Ackerman is communicating with you, but the debunker or skeptic would say, but maybe not. Maybe it's not all connected except in your own mind. I listen to their argument. Mm-hmm. I try to give them credit for being sincere in what they believe, because I used to think that way, you know. But when you're the recipient of these things that I call messages, some of them subtle and some of them very obvious, you really react in a very strong way where you just, you know, I have to use the word intuitively know. That something is operating here that you can't see and that it's deliberate.
Yeah.
So that's why I ask people, you know, please get the Life After Death project. We've put out the, since it was on Sci-Fi, the first movie. Now it's a two DVD together. Mm-hmm. You can get it at Amazon or, you know, Target, Barnes & Noble, wherever online they sell DVDs, you can find the Life After Death project. Don't forget the word project or you won't find it. And we put lots of bonus features in there, too. So the whole thing, it's over 4 hours.
Yeah.
I've been 4 years at this. And I just had to tell this story, Richard, because people have to know.
Well, absolutely. I have to say that there was an image that came into mind as you were sharing all of this. And that's from the movie about Temple Grandin, when she was in the slaughterhouse and she was watching the cattle being put to death. Didn't freak her out, but she kept saying, where did they go? They were just here and now they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And she wasn't talking about the body. She was talking about, if you will, the essence, the spark, the personality of that particular piece of livestock, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the same question that we're asking that these days, where did Grandpa go? Where did Grandma go? And by the way, to your point about the aspects of different types of death, I had an interesting experience a couple of years ago when our landlord passed away. And in the last year of his life, and I certainly understand why he was cranky the last year of his life, because he knew he was dying. Mm-hmm. But his family was working with him. He was working through a lot of stuff. He was trying to clear stuff up, bring closure with relatives and siblings and with his children and so forth. And I remember they held a wake, and his body lay, I'll say, in state in his home, in his bed for, I think, a day or two. And I remember we went in to pay our respects, and he had the most peaceful, if not chipper, smile on his face that I don't think I ever saw while he was alive. And I remember talking with one of his daughters about that, and she basically said that he had taken care of business, that he had worked really hard in the last 12 months so that he wasn't going to be taking a lot of this baggage with him. And I thought, what an extraordinary experience for an individual to have, let alone a family. And you don't get those opportunities very often because you don't know when it's going to happen. And so that leads me to basically say to folks, you need to take care of business now because you don't know when it's going to happen. By the way, we do know when breaks are going to happen on this program, and we're going to take one right now. We're talking with Paul Davis, and he is the writer, producer of what we've been talking about is the Life After Death Project. Remember that when you're looking it up, especially if you're looking it up on Google or Amazon, wherever it is that you are going to search. And we encourage you to do just that. We're going to take a brief break here. We're going to come back and talk more with Paul Davis. David's about a couple of his other projects, which also are very intriguing to me, and we're going to do that in just a moment. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay where you are.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And we are talking with Paul Davis about not only his Life After Death Project, the two DVD set, which I have seen, and it's fun to watch because this subject is, I often want to say it's near and dear to my heart, but it's kind of hard to say that when I haven't had those experiences. But I have to say that whenever anyone of note or someone I know who's close to me passes, my first thought has not been of sadness and, oh, I'm going to miss them and so forth. It's, I wonder what they're going through now. I wonder what their experiences are. And I know that with your friend, your dear friend and mentor of, as you say, some 40 years, Forry Ackerman, I am going to base this on what I've seen in the documentary, both DVDs, that you kind of have an idea of what he is up to and what he's experiencing. And that is, a lot of fun, even if it might be at your expense.
Mm-hmm. Fair game. Richard, do you have a link to our website as part of your setup here?
Absolutely we do. And that website would be?
LifeAfterDeathProject.com.
And that's where people are going to go to find out more about both you, Forry Ackerman, and the project, the Life After Death Project.
I also just wanted to,
yes,
to say that recently I was invited up to Canada to speak at Idea City, a conference that is like the TED conference. It's the Canadian TED conference, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
They only give each speaker 17 minutes.
Yes.
But I had 17 minutes in the beautiful Kerner Hall at University of Toronto to lay out all as much as I could of this evidence and tell people why I was so serious about it. And Moses Znamer, who runs the conference and who owns several networks through his Zoomer Media up in Canada, is not only going to put the movie on Canadian TV at some point, but he has just put my talk online. And if you Google Idea City and my name, Paul, last name Davids, that's David with an S at the end, you know, put those two together, the talk will come up and you'll see it was really an amazing experience with 600 people in this hall, absolutely filled. I think they were spellbound and the whole experience was spellbinding.
Well, you've been writing, producing and directing films for years, and now you've put together, of course, the Life After Death Project, but you've also two others that are very intriguing to and for me. One of them is one in particular having to do with both the life of Jesus, but also another one called Before We Say Goodbye, having to do with an experience that a family had over the imminent demise, if you will, of or the soon passing of one of the male members of the family,
the patriarch.
And I know enough, especially when it comes to the Hispanic community. On my mother's side of the family, we had matriarchs. The women were at the head, and they were the ones that called the shots. My great grandmother and my grandmother. But I know how that hierarchy works, and that you show great respect and so forth. But at the same time, you talk in this movie talks an awful lot about Our Lady of Guadalupe and a journey that was taken down to Mexico. And of course, I'm very familiar with that, as well as people's experiences with miracles at Fatima, at Lourdes, at Medjugorje. And even there is even a sacred site in Ireland that people also will go to. So these kinds of experiences are happening in a lot of different places down through history and around the world, where people are, shall we say, reconnecting with the heart, if not the depth, of their heritage, if you will. I mean, it's even more than that. It's that spiritual connection, that union, if you will, with a greater power.
And that kind of theme attracts me for the films that I've made, and it comes into a number of them, you know, including The Artist and The Shaman, which I made, and Starry Night, then we have Before We Say Goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
This was based on a stage play that I saw in New Mexico. I thought I'd made a great discovery when I saw this play to come to know Patricia Crespin, the Hispanic American writer of that play and many other plays. I thought she had such an incredible talent. I was really floored by the depth of characterization and the way the play helped me understand her people, the culture, their beliefs. It sensitized me as an Anglo, you know, so much to the Hispanic American culture. And I'm someone who's visited Mexico many times, and I do speak some Spanish, but it opened up a lot of worlds for me. So I made an agreement with her to make a movie out of her play. We worked on it for years. It is almost entirely Hispanic American cast. We filmed in New Mexico, and we filmed in Mexico. And part of the story, as you mentioned, has to do with the faith in Our Lady of Guadalupe. There was a purported miracle that is so important to Catholics, especially Hispanic American Catholics. In the year 1531, in what is now Mexico City, where a Native American reported that he saw a lady from heaven. And this was interpreted as being the Virgin Mary. He saw her a couple of times. And she imprinted on his cactus cloth an image of her face. Now, you can see this today. It's on display in Mexico City. In the Basilica for the Virgin of Guadalupe. And a cactus cloth like the one he was wearing, you know, it should have probably deteriorated completely in 50 to 70 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the image, why would this image maintain over 500 years? I mean, almost about half of a millennium.
Yeah.
You can still see this image of this lady from heaven that he saw. And it's been tested by science, which is determined using ultraviolet, infrared testing, that there is no underpainting. There was no artist, you know, who worked on this, who sketched it first. And the core image there, they cannot identify as any pigment. So it is a mystery. It's regarded as a miracle in the Catholic faith. John Paul II declared Juan Diego, the peasant this happened to, as a saint. And my film, Before We Say Goodbye, focuses on a family that they're going to lose the head of their family. Death is coming. His wife believes in miracles and believes a miracle happened to her through faith, through help, and the intercession of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and she makes a pilgrimage to Mexico City on his behalf. And what happens in the story is such a twist. I'm not going to give away. There won't be any spoilers here.
Okay.
But it is such a journey of the heart. You know, there's laughs and there's a lot of tears, but it just opens the heart and it leaves you in a really wonderful place. So what I like your listeners to know is, it's a great movie for grandmas and moms. If you know you want to give somebody a gift of something that could really move them, particularly someone who has faith. I mean, Catholics really do love it. Hispanic Americans really relate to it. But to say that it's only for that culture would be like saying my big fat Greek wedding is only for Greeks. not true. And a film that focuses on a specific culture like this, I think, really helps us all, especially since America is now, 40 million Hispanic Americans? Why shouldn't it be seen by all Americans to help them understand better the life and family, traditions and faith of our Hispanic Americans?
Absolutely. I mean, there is that heritage we have here in Santa Barbara. For example, in August, we have what's called Fiesta, and it's celebrating old Spanish days. Sadly, there was a situation. I say this sadly because a big brouhaha broke up for a day or so. They put up on the city lights flags every week. There were every few weeks they change them out, sometimes for the symphony, sometimes for the Red Cross. Well, when Fiesta rolled around, somebody put the flags up, and they were Mexican flags from Mexico. And this did not set well with the old Spanish days people, because this was not old Mexican days. And there is a difference. I know this because a woman that I used to work with back in Phoenix, we were chatting, and I said, so you and your family are from Mexico? And she became irate with me, saying, I am not from Mexico, and neither is my family. I am from Spain. My family is from Spain. I mean, she was proud of her heritage. It wasn't she was denigrating Mexico or Mexicans. It was that she's often confused for being Mexican, and she was not. She was Spanish. And there is a difference. There's a big difference. But nonetheless, I think it's real important. Now, you have some other film. Now, you mentioned Starry Night. You also have a film called Roswell, Timothy Leary's Death. Of course,
Timothy Leary's Dead. Those are the words of a song by the Moody Blues.
Okay.
Timothy Leary's Dead. Yes. And that became the title of a song that's the biography of LSD guru from Harvard, Timothy Leary, which I made with him the last year of his life.
Which is rather interesting, because I have just seen some information stating that apparently there is new research that has begun into LSD. Rather interesting. And then, of course, another film that you've made called Jesus in India, going back to 2008, which is a documentary on American adventurer Ed T. Martin and his search for Russian...
The missing years. The missing years of Christ,
right.
Age 18 to 30, the Bible doesn't tell us.
And now, I have been, and I have both multiple versions of the canonical Bible, the authorized Bibles of both the Protestant and Catholic Church. I also have a couple of volumes of what are called the Lost Books of the Bible and the Forgotten Books of Eden. And they talk in some of these books about those years. Now, the reason why I bring this up is basically to say that it's like the information is there, but no one's willing to talk about it. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And
yes.
That he studied with the Essenes.
And you want to know how good the information is.
Well, yeah.
And this, of course, is one of the challenges of a documentary.
Exactly.
But for me, here was a part of the core of it. There are these 18 years that are only referred to by one sentence in Luke. Jesus grew in stature and in wisdom and in favor with God and man. And then that's a jump cut from age 12 to age 30,
yeah,
where he's being baptized by the River Jordan. So where was he during that time? And biblical scholars will debate this. But there has been the belief prevalent in India going way, way back that Christ came to India during many of those years and was among Hindus and Buddhists. And Edward T. Martin, raised as a fundamentalist Christian in Texas, took such an interest in these legends that really he was basically booted out of his fundamentalist church, Church of Christ. He became sort of persona non grata. They didn't want to hear about it. And Ed embarked on journeys to India, Afghanistan. He was in the Peace Corps there for a while. And he followed every trail that he could to see what basis there might be for the legends. And that's where I come in. I read a book that he wrote about it called King of Travelers. Actually, I ended up republishing that book, and you can find that online easily by Edward T. Martin. And he convinced me I should go to India with him. We got a crew together, mainly Hindus. We had help from one Islamic there and one Syrian Thomas Christian, because St. Thomas is known to have gone to India after the crucifixion. And this has been acknowledged by Pope John Paul II, who journeyed to India to pay homage to St. Thomas there. You can visit the site of his original church. I think it's called Madras, or Chennai. We were there. So there are these really early traditions of Christianity in India that do go back 2,000 years. But was Jesus himself ever there? There were Jewish enclaves there. There's a lot of Hebrew names. In Kashmir, there was an ancient Temple of Solomon. And many of the customs of the natives there are ancient Hebrew traditions. In other words, for someone thinking in terms of reuniting the lost tribes of Israel, reaching out to India, Kashmir, I mean, this would have been on the agenda. And there were ways to get there, of course, the Silk Road in those days. So we went to many ancient Hindu temples, learning centers, Buddhist monasteries. We were particularly interested in the origins of the story that there is an ancient manuscript that fills in the missing years, and that's at a Buddhist monastery called Hemis. At about 14,000 foot elevation, and in Ladakh. And so this manuscript had been translated by a Russian explorer, Nicholas Nodovich, and then years later retranslated by a Hindu scholar, Swami Abhedananda, and seen by others as well. So it's been seen and translated by enough people that it's reasonable to say the manuscript really does exist. We don't quite know how old it is. Does it really go back to the time of Christ? And why can't we get our hands on it when over 100 years ago, people, including Nicholas Rorick, the great Russian artist who reported the find of that at the Hemis Monastery. So we were in search of that manuscript. I can't say that we found it. We did get there, and we got the official story of one of the head monks at Hemis. And the story is just very, very much alive as a result from our research. We don't have a smoking gun that proves that Jesus was in India, but you know, they say where there's smoke, there's fire. Mm-hmm. And I think we found a lot of smoke. We found a lot of indications that would make a reasonable person think yeah. it really could be true. And I think one of the greatest successes, accomplishments of this movie is this. That this guy, Ed Martin, thrown out of his fundamentalist church for having these wacky ideas, right? They don't want to hear about Jesus in India. Not the Bible that they know.
Yeah.
And yet the great... there's a great biblical scholar at Princeton University who actually said that this theory cannot be ruled out. Elaine Pagels said she left it within the realm of things that were possible, that were possibly true. So the very fact that Elaine Pagels couldn't shut the door on it shows that this fellow, Ed Martin, is not such a crackpot. This is a legitimate area of investigation, and it ought to be of interest to all Christians. So we call the movie Jesus in India. You can find the DVD pretty much anywhere online that sells DVDs. Mm-hmm. It was on the Sundance Channel probably about a dozen times a few years ago when it came out. They showed it as their main Christmas time documentary, Easter documentary, for a couple years running. So it's had a lot of play and notoriety, and still available. So for those who haven't come in touch with it, I can tell you it was one of the greatest adventures of my life to go to India and to see India in that movie as I saw it. I hope you'll take a look.
Absolutely. Well, I have been dealing with these kinds of questions for a good 30 years or more. In particular, when I was working for a Christian radio station back in Phoenix for 15 years.
Oh.
And as I have shared this story many times, it was the greatest education I was ever paid for. I learned a little bit about broadcasting while I was there, too, in addition to comparative religion, sociology, psychology, political science, and on and on. And one of the things that had that always struck me when asking these kinds of questions, did Jesus ever travel in India, since the Bible is, quote unquote, silent on that point? Mm-hmm. I would always bring up the passage in the Bible allegedly quoted by Jesus that ye shall know the truth and the truth will set you free.
Mm-hmm.
Now, years ago in my first marriage, I was questioning this whole authenticity of and I was a practicing Catholic at the time. The authenticity of crucifixes. Now, the research that I had done said that the final indignation during a crucifixion, and especially Jesus' crucifixion, was that they were stripped naked on the cross. They were not wearing a thing. Mm-hmm. And I remember asking a priest, he was actually the Monsignor at the church we were married in, my first wife and I, and he was in our home, blessing our home that particular season, and I have a question for you about this. And so I posed that to him. Rather than him saying, no, that's not true, his answer absolutely floored me. And he said, well, the reason why we don't have depictions of Jesus on the cross naked is because we don't want to upset the sensibilities of the people. And again, that phrase, ye shall know the truth and the truth will set you free, came to mind. And that just made no sense. I mean, I understood what he said.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, wait a minute, but if that's not the truth, if that's not what really happened, if Jesus actually did study with the Essenes and the Egyptians and the Indians, and, you know, the Hindus and the Buddhists and so forth, why is that a crime to be asking those questions? Do you think that when people find out that Jesus studied with these various groups, that Catholics are going to defect to these other groups?
Well, you know, there's a really interesting point about this, too, Richard, because one of the objections of the Orthodox is the, you know, their faith that that Jesus came to Earth with divine truth. He didn't need to study with anybody. Mm. You know, he was delivering the message from his Father. But as we know, he was a troublemaker in Jerusalem, right?
Yes, yes, he was.
You know, he didn't make friends with everybody when he turned over the tables of the money changers in the temple. And the manuscript that we're looking for that was translated that describes his exploits among the Hindus portrays him in perfect character as a troublemaker among the Hindus, that as someone who objected to the caste system. And they had rules that their holy Vedas could not be read to the untouchables. Mm. And he had the audacity to read their holy Vedas to the untouchables.
Yeah.
So you get a portrait of somebody that they were out to, I don't think they used crucifixion, but they were certainly out to assassinate him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Based on the fact that he didn't just sit still and stand for what they believed and what their culture was. And part of the story is that he had to escape
yeah.
for his life, so it just makes the story more interesting, right?
No,
to
very
fill in
much
some
so.
Of this mystery. And the Islamics, who hold Jesus in reverence as a saint, as a prophet, let's say prophet, he is one of their prophets. They refer to him as the King of Travelers. Now, where did that come from?
Mm. Interesting.
And that's why Ed's book was called King of Travelers.
Yeah.
Jesus' Lost Years in India. The King of Travelers would suggest somebody who traveled to many lands and places with the message, with
yeah.
the word, if you will.
Exactly.
So it helps not to have a closed mind and shut off these conversations before they even begin.
Exactly. Exactly. And again, these conversations, I am thrilled with because it elicits new questions in me, but in terms of the dialogue that I get into with the other participants in the conversation, they're curious. Usually they're just as curious as I am as to trying to get to the bottom of things. Years ago, when I was a little more zealous about these kinds of things, someone came to me and said, you know, maybe you should leave some of these questions unanswered for the next life, the next world, if you will.
Uh-huh.
So you have something to do, you know, kind of thing, you know. And I thought, okay, well, I like the logic behind that. That works for me. You know, I don't want to, it's kind of like a baseball team, you know, scoring 65 runs in one game, and they have no more runs for the rest of the season, kind of thing. But I have always been curious about these kinds of things, and having read this one five book volume, The Life and Teachings of the Masters of the Far East, there was a wonderful section, and this also goes to keeping an open mind for those who choose to delve into that type of work, because it was fascinating to me. It was written by Spalding, and it was the encounter that the group had with supposedly with Jesus and with Pilate. And I remember highlighting in the book, because it was so profound for me, almost brought tears to my eyes, was when Jesus began to basically sort of lament the fact that man had deified him, had put him up on a pedestal, and he wanted to commune with them. He wanted to be right down there with them, mm-hmm. hanging out and doing stuff and what have you. And they put him up on this pedestal, and it's like, and he missed, in essence, from the story, he missed that. He wanted that so badly, you know, and I thought, wow. You know, and what does that say about us as individuals to one another, that there are times we shut people out and shut people off and we don't want to hear them. And nowadays, especially in our political arena, and I know you're familiar with this as well, Paul,
yeah.
You start talking about a particular subject from one point of view and, you know, you're dead to rights. You're done.
Well,
it's over because you're wrong. You're of the devil, if you will. You're in the dark, et cetera, and we can't even talk anymore about stuff.
You know, I kind of have to laugh because there is sort of an establishment point of view on almost every subject.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And there certainly is in religion. The establishment point of view doesn't embrace Jesus in India. They really wouldn't necessarily embrace the Life After Death Project or
right.
My Artist and the Shaman. And the Wall Street Journal, a religion writer for that newspaper, when My Jesus in India was on the Sundance Channel, she wrote a review in which she disparagingly referred to the film as a caravan of crackpots. And it brings a smile to my face even now, and it's a badge of honor that I wear. You know, as I think to myself, okay, who are these crackpots in Jesus in India, where we have an apostolic nuncio of John Paul II. There's the, if you will, the Pope of Hinduism. He's called the Shankaracharya. Mm-hmm. The Dalai Lama is in it. There are two religion teachers of Georgetown University. There's a famous rabbi from Loyola University. So, who are the crackpots? I mean, they considered Ed Martin a crackpot for having the idea in the first place.
Yeah.
I made Roswell focusing on one of the military officers in that UFO case who was branded a crackpot for coming forward with the story that they had had extraterrestrial contact back in 1947. And in the Life After Death Project, there are debunkers out there who are – you know, they're trying to turn me into the crackpot because I'm the one reporting the fact that something really impossible happened to me after Fari Ackerman died.
Yeah.
And they'll twist my words and they'll manipulate the facts as they've been presented, either deliberately or because they never paid attention. You know, and this is kind of what you go through when you're dealing with controversial material. But it doesn't dissuade me.
No,
and I think it's all the more reason that everybody should see Paul David's films because they're all about a
exactly.
caravan of people that that the establishment says are crackpots.
Again, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Richard Dugan. Thank you for listening. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until we get together next time, love to Lal.